Ashur, than to the heart of Mitanni. Later, it would be part of the kingdom of Assyria. But during this period, the late 15th and early 14th century BCE, Assyria was subject to the Mitannian Empire. King Saushtatar had probably been responsible for conquering the region. A later inscription records that he stole a door of silver and gold from the land of Assyria and took it back to his palace. Queen Ammoniah apparently didn't live in the capital city of Arrapha, at least not all the time. She had a house in the small nearby town of Nuzi, which was home to about 1,600 people. Archaeologists excavated Nuzi from 1925 to 1931, and they uncovered about 5,000 cuneiform tablets. These have provided us with wonderful details about this era. Ammoniah's home was impressive. It was a villa extending over 1,200 square meters, or almost 13,000 square feet, with 35 rooms. Beautifully decorated, it had tiled floors and fashionable wall paintings that showed the influence of Egyptian and Aegean art. Ammoniah lived there with her son, Crown Prince Shilwateshub, and his family. Shilwateshub was in line for the throne of Arrapha. In time, he would become the vassal of the Mitannian king. When the house was excavated, archaeologists uncovered about 730 cuneiform tablets there, recording the business affairs of Prince Shilwateshub, his 8 wives, and his mother. Ammoniah's archives show that the land she received from the Mitannian king was just one of 6 large estates that she owned. Quite a few of the tablets listed rations provided by Prince Shilwateshub to every member of his household, including his mother, his wives, and the dozens of servants, hired men, and slaves who helped run the estate. It's surprising in a way that Ammoniah would need to be provided with food and clothing from her son's household budget, since she was such a powerful landowner herself. But she was given much more than she needed for her own maintenance. Perhaps she used these goods to provide for her own servants. Meanwhile, the family archive shows that her son made loans to people in the town. As one of the richest men there, he had grain, silver, and wood to spare. And his loans were provided free of interest to people in need. This sounds generous, but we can see from his records that he still foreclosed on people who couldn't pay him back. The situation in the kingdom of Arrapha was somewhat typical for the Mitannian Empire. It was a relatively peaceful era, so there are few records in Nuzi of any military activity. The Mitannian king had many vassals who paid him tribute, like the king of Arrapha. The vassals in turn taxed their subjects in order to provide for their own needs and to come up with the wealth for their tribute payments. But aside from demanding tribute and giving land to important people, the king of Mitanni seems mostly to have left Arrapha alone. Besides the letter about Ammoniah's land, almost no records from Nuzi mention the great king at all. The people there were preoccupied with local matters. And Arrapha was a wealthy kingdom. Even the mayor of Nuzi had an opulent palace with more than 100 rooms. His toilets had marble seats, and some of the private rooms had marble floors. Archaeologists have noticed that there was a significant divide between rich and poor in Nuzi, and in some of the other vassal kingdoms of Mitanni. Vast houses, like the one owned by Shilwateshub, shared neighborhoods with the much smaller dwellings of the poor. But not all of Mitanni's small kingdoms were like this. Some cities were not dominated by palaces, and in those cities, there was less of a divide between rich and poor. The houses are much more similar to one another in size. Several sites near the Euphrates in Syria are like this. One of the best known of these is called Amar. In towns like Amar, a group of local men called the elders played a big role in running things and overseeing legal issues that arose. Local kings existed, but they weren't very powerful. Let's go back to that land that the Mitannian king had given to Ammoniah. We have records of a lot of royal land grants in this era, and not just in Mitanni. Back in the old Babylonian period, between about 1900 and 1595 BCE, kings had provided some of their officials and soldiers with fields so that they could support their families. But during the following era, the Late Bronze Age, royal gifts of land to officials got very much bigger, including whole towns and the lands around them. Most of these landholdings were much larger than any one household would need. The stage between these two extremes can be seen in some of the documents from the Kingdom of Hana in eastern Syria. In the period between about 1600 and 1450 BCE, before the time of Ammoniah's archive, quite a few contracts have been found in Hana that record royal grants of land. Some of these are for many fields, but some are just for a small property, a single house in one case. There were a number of clauses to these land grant contracts. They started with the description of the land itself, its size, where it was located, and who owned the lands around it. It's interesting to note that the land around the fields being given by the king is often described as belonging to the palace. So the kings seem to have been claiming control of more and more of the land in the kingdom. It was probably less possible than before for private individuals to buy and sell property. The next clause noted who owned the land. In a private sale, this is where you would find the name of the seller. But in the land grants, the current owner was the king. But he wasn't the sole owner. The scribe listed the king and a number of local gods as the owners. It seems that the land wasn't just perceived as royal, but as shared with the gods. Then there was an oath sworn in the names of these same gods. Strangely enough, this was followed by a threat of punishment on anyone who broke the contract. These types of punishments were almost always found on contracts for the sale of land in the Hana kingdom. If someone went back on their word, hot asphalt would be smeared on their head. This protected the buyer from the seller denying the legality of their transaction. But who would go back on a land grant? The person receiving the land presumably would have had no reason to contest it. And if the king changed his mind, would officials smear hot asphalt on his head? Certainly not. So the clause probably referred to some previous owner who might claim that the land was actually his. The list of witnesses came next, and these were almost all high officials, often with the king's son as the first witness. One final detail is that the Hana kings always sealed the land grant contracts with their elaborate royal cylinder seals. That means the kings probably were physically there when the contract was drawn up. So the awarding of these land grants might have been accompanied by some sort of ceremony with some of the most important people in the kingdom present, including the king. Starting around 1500 BCE, kings from several other kingdoms adopted this same idea of granting extensive lands to important civil servants and religious leaders. We find grants like this in Hatti and Mitanni and in Babylonia as well. So, for example, there's a tablet from the reign of Saushtatar that records a gift of land in a place called Basiru. And there are several later Mitannian and Hittite tablets of the same kind. Like the earlier Hana kingdom texts, they almost all bear the king's seal. Sometimes it was the great king who was awarding the land. Sometimes it was a local vassal king. The original gift from the Mitannian king to Queen Ammoniah probably was recorded in a contract like this, impressed with the king's seal. We don't have that one, but the change in the borders of the lands that she was given came in the form of a letter, and again it was sealed. In Kassite Babylonia, a similar phenomenon was taking place, but most of the records are found not on clay tablets, but on stone stelas. These were set up in temples, recording land gifts from the king. They're known as kudurus, and they were an innovation of this era in Babylonia. Like the land grants from Hana, Hatti, and Mitanni, they include a description of the land gift, and they note that it's from the king, and they give the name of the man who received it. As with the gift to Ammoniah, each recipient received a huge amount of land, probably a whole village with its surrounding fields. The kudurus don't list the witnesses or the date, but they add a new feature, a curse on anyone who would change the agreement. The obvious person who might go back on his word was the king. But the king couldn't be held to account by any mortal person. The kudurus seem to have been set up by the recipients, who were often priests, and who were appealing to the gods to hold the king accountable if he took back the land that he'd provided to them. Some scholars have described this widespread institution of royal land grants as something like a feudal system. The king gave out large estates to his officials and expected their loyalty in return. The officials benefited from the income from the land, but they also were expected to take responsibility for collecting taxes on their estates. But European feudalism was different from this in many ways. The contracts and kudurus recording Late Bronze Age land grants don't usually list what was required of the recipients, and the military side of later medieval feudalism doesn't seem to be present at all. But the system seems to have been an effective way of maintaining control of the lands under Mitannian, Babylonian, and Hittite control. I mentioned that in the town of Nuzi, you'd hardly guess that the Mitannian kings ruled the area. Their names are so rarely found on the tablets. But in some other regions at this time, the kings seem to have been surprisingly active in a number of aspects of their subjects' lives. In the western part of Mitanni and in Hatti, a whole bunch of different types of transactions are described as having taken place in the presence of the king, and many of them had his seal impressed on the tablet. Now, some of the events at which the king was present were as important as the awarding of land grants. Things like the creation of important treaties or legal decisions by the king. You can absolutely understand why the king would have been present for these and why he would have impressed his seal on the documents that were produced. But some of the things that happened in the presence of the king were just common everyday transactions. Someone bought a bull. Someone else bought a slave. A slave was freed by his owner. A woman gave a vineyard and some olives to another woman. All of these took place in the presence of the king. Why did the king need to be there for these everyday occurrences? There's a whole category of tablets that were impressed with the king's seal, and it seems to have been the same seal. So, for example, impressions of the seal of Saushtatar have been found not only on Ammoniah's letter from Nuzi in the far east of the empire, but also on tablets from Tel Brak in the center of the empire, and on others from the sites of Tel Bazi and Umm El Mara in the northwest. These sites were hundreds of miles apart. So why was this true? Why and how did the king's seal get to be on so many different types of tablets in so many distant places? Were the kings of Mitanni in the habit of traveling all around their kingdom, hearing legal cases, and being present for purchases that people made? Or did men and women come to the capital city, get an appointment to be in the presence of the king for the writing of their contracts, and then take the sealed tablets home with them? It could be that both of these things happened. As for why, it may have had something to do with the king's visibility. Today, we don't need to get physically close to our political leaders in order to feel that they have a lot of power over our lives. We see them and we hear about pretty much every detail of what they do. We can't avoid them even if we try. They're all over the internet, in every newspaper and magazine, on TV, in talk shows, and on cable news 24/7. But in the world before mass media, the king wasn't omnipresent at all. The Hellenistic Greeks and the Romans used coins with images of the ruler's face on them as propaganda. Coins were useful reminders of who was in charge, because absolutely everybody used them to pay for things. Eventually, the leaders even put a second image on the back to commemorate some great victory or achievement. But for our Late Bronze Age kings, coins were a long way off in the future. People still weighed out silver on a scale when they paid for things. So how did the king keep his name in people's minds? How did he remind his people of who he was and what he'd done? If particular legal contracts needed the king's presence, well, that reminded you about him, and maybe even got you into the same room with him. But could the king really have been there so often for so many minor legal procedures? It would have been very time-consuming. The kings had their kingdoms to run. Perhaps the actual king didn't need to be present at all for some of these transactions. Maybe an official seal-bearer was allowed to roll the king's seal on some of these tablets for him. It could even be that a statue of the king could have served in place of the king himself. There's no certain evidence for this, but since everyone believed that statues had their own life force, and that some part of the king was captured in his statue, this might have been a good solution to the need for the king to be in many places at once. Royal statues certainly stood in for the king in several other situations, like when oaths were sworn in his name, and they reminded the populace of how important he was. In these various ways, the kings of Mitanni seem to have been able to control their realms without necessarily resorting to force. The power of vassals to break away from the king was limited by the fact that the great king directly owned some of the lands within their realms, and he could give those lands to whomever he chose. Queen Ammoniah, for example, probably felt an allegiance to the king of Mitanni because of the lands he'd awarded to her, as well as an allegiance to her husband, the vassal king of Arapa. The increased engagement of the king with intricate details of the lives of his subjects might also have convinced them of his legitimate right to rule over them. After all, like rulers in any period of ancient Near Eastern history, the kings of the Late Bronze Age needed to be sure that soldiers and laborers would appear when they were drafted, and that people would pay their taxes. If the king was someone who lived far away in a capital city you'd never visited, he had to find ways to remind you of his power and of your role as his subject. So if he gave land to someone you knew, or if his seal was needed on a contract you had to draw up, or if he sometimes visited your city to hear legal cases, or if his statue was there in your town needing offerings, then he was a real presence in your life. He was someone for whom you might be willing to work or to fight. The Late Bronze Age seems, as a result, to have been an era of peace and prosperity, not just between the great kings, but also within their kingdoms. Mitanni thrived for more than 150 years, but towards the middle of the 14th century, things started to go downhill. We get a glimpse of this in the correspondence of King Tushratta of Mitanni with the kings of Egypt. Tushratta's daughter, Taduhepa, had married the pharaoh Amenhotep III. And at that time, he'd asked a favor of his Egyptian ally. He wanted a gold statue of Taduhepa. This request for a statue of his daughter had a precedent. When Amenhotep III had married a Babylonian princess, he'd sent a statue of that princess to her father, the king of Babylon. Perhaps the statue could serve as a physical confirmation of the marriage relationship between the two kings. That's what Tushratta implied when he'd first written to Amenhotep about this. He quoted what he thought other people would say about the statue of his daughter once it arrived. He wrote that, "Before earth and before the heavens are the words spoken, this gold image is Taduhepa, the daughter of Tushratta, the lord of Mitanni, whom he gave as wife of Amenhotep, the lord of Egypt. And Amenhotep made a molten gold image and full of love dispatched it to Tushratta. People would, according to him, see the statues as confirming the alliance and love between himself and the pharaoh." Later, Tushratta added to the request. Now he wanted a statue of himself, as well as one of his daughter Taduhepa. This obviously couldn't have been a real likeness, since Tushratta had never traveled to Egypt, and none of the Egyptian artisans would ever have seen him. But that wasn't a concern. Statues weren't intended to look like the person they depicted. They were idealized. Tushratta was also now more specific. He said the statue should be, in his words, of solid cast gold, one of myself, and a second statue, a statue of Taduhepa, my daughter. Solid cast gold? That was quite a request. Amenhotep III wrote back, "Don't talk of giving statues just of solid cast gold. I will give you ones made also of lapis lazuli." Lapis lazuli is a deep blue stone that was greatly prized by the ancient peoples. You can imagine that Tushratta must have been thrilled. We know from royal letters found in the late 19th century in Amarna in Egypt that Amenhotep III had the statues made. Not only that, he made sure that the Mitannian diplomatic corps saw them and could attest to their existence. But the pharaoh didn't get around to sending them before he died. At the time of his death, Amenhotep III had been married to Taduhepa for only 2 years. His son Akhenaten inherited the throne, and some of his father's wives. Akhenaten married Taduhepa, which meant that Tushratta was still the father-in-law of the king of Egypt. King Tushratta hoped that their relationship would be just as close as the bond he'd had with Akhenaten's father. He expressed this repeatedly in his letters. But Akhenaten turned out not to be a reliable ally or correspondent. For Tushratta, the big change in their relationship was all wrapped up with the issue of the gold statues. Akhenaten simply didn't send them. The gift that was eventually transmitted was something less than the Mitannian king had been anticipating. Tushratta described what happened. He said, "My brother," that's Akhenaten, "sent me statues made of wood." They were gold-plated, but they weren't the solid gold statues he'd been promised. He wrote to Egypt over and over after this to complain about how he'd been snubbed. He even wrote to Akhenaten's mother, Tia, asking her to put in a word with her son to convince him to send the gold statues. The failure to send a gift might sound trivial to us, but so much of the alliances between the great kings of this era took the form of reciprocal gift-giving. Tushratta was obsessed with Akhenaten's failure to send the statues, not just because he wanted more gold, but because he clearly felt himself to be slipping out of Egyptian favor. He depended on his alliances, and the physical proof of them was seen in the regular exchange of letters, gifts, and messengers. As far as we know, the gold statues never arrived, and Mitanni's relationship with Egypt never returned to the warm friendship Tushratta had shared with Amenhotep III. Pharaoh Akhenaten was no longer interested in maintaining close ties with Mitanni. Meanwhile, the Hittites were gaining in power and becoming more aggressive, and they had never been friendly with Mitanni, even at the best of times. You can imagine that Tushratta was getting worried, and he was right to. Mitanni's days as a great power were almost over.
Lecture 19, The Late Bronze Age and the End of Peace.
More than 3,000 years ago, a ship left the island of Cyprus, 20 tons of cargo and royal gifts. It was probably heading for Greece. The wooden boat was 49 feet long and sturdily built. But off the coast, at a place now known as Ulubarun in Turkey, the crew faced a crisis, and the ship sank. It stayed there, untouched, on the sea floor until it was discovered by underwater archaeologists in 1982. Over the next decade, the archaeologists were able to recover many objects from the wreck and to begin to piece together a surprisingly vivid picture of ancient Near Eastern trade. When the ship was first recovered, there was a lot of discussion about which country it might have come from. Was it from Canaan or Greece or Cyprus? The crew's possessions consisted of objects from all over the place, including an Egyptian gold scarab, Mycenaean pots from Greece, and sets of Canaanite weights. And the ship's hold was packed with 10 tons of copper from Cyprus in the form of 354 ingots. Each ingot weighed about 50 pounds. There was no obvious single source for the goods on board. The director of the excavation concluded that the crew was probably mostly from Syria and Canaan. Four of the passengers appeared to be merchants who'd brought along sets of balance weights so that they could weigh gold and silver payments or bulk goods that they might be buying. Someone, presumably the captain of the ship, had a Canaanite sword. the crew would have used the simple bowls, knives, and Canaanite oil lamps that were found. They fished with fish hooks and net sinkers, and they seem to have had a simple life on board. To pass the time, they kept a set of knuckle bones. The knuckle bones might have worked much like dice in modern games. The boat wasn't just a trading vessel, though. Two other men on board appear to have been ambassadors, and some of the goods in the hold might have been luxury gifts for their king in Greece, perhaps received from the king of Alashia in what is now Cyprus. This was during the Mycenaean period in Greece, hundreds of years before the classical era. It was the time that provided the setting for the later legends of the Iliad and the Odyssey. We know from contemporaneous records that the king of Alashia sent vast amounts of copper to the pharaoh in Egypt in exchange for luxury goods. So he probably had similar relationships with other lands, possibly including Mycenaean Greece. Each of the shipwrecked diplomats had a 5-piece set of Mycenaean pouring and drinking vessels. Each one also had a necklace, a Mycenaean sword, and a seal to stamp his goods. Between them, they owned 5 razors to shave with. They were elite, important men. Their swords demonstrate that. And they didn't have weights and measures, so they weren't merchants. The cargo also included 1 ton of tin, which is just the right amount to make 11 tons of bronze when combined with the 10 tons of copper that were also aboard the ship. Bronze was essential to the economy of this period. It was used to make all kinds of tools, weapons, and statues. Regions that didn't have access to copper and tin had no choice but to import it. There were also almost 800 pounds of glass ingots from Egypt and the Near East, along with 24 stone anchors and 150 Canaanite jars, half of which were filled with 1,000 pounds of terebinth resin. Terebinth was used as incense and as part of the mix for making perfumed oil. There were other goods as well, ebony logs and ivory tusks from Africa, and 3 ostrich eggshells, along with spices and olives. So the ship must have picked up some goods in Canaan, things like the terebinth, the tin, the glass ingots, and then it moved on to Cyprus. There, perhaps, the Mycenaean ambassadors joined the crew after having visited the Alashian court, and the boat was loaded with the copper. The vessel was probably on its way to Greece when it sank. We don't know if the crew, the merchants, and the envoys survived. No skeletons were found, and the boat was only 60 yards from shore, so perhaps they did. One great thing about the Ulubarin shipwreck is that it's like a time capsule, frozen just the way it was before sinking. We know from letters between kings of this time that vast amounts of gold, copper, and other luxury goods were regularly sent from one court to another, and the shipwreck shows how some of these goods were transported. The Akkadian language of Mesopotamia was the lingua franca of the age, and letters written in Akkadian passed regularly between the courts of the Near Eastern kings. Only a tiny fraction of what was written has survived, and just a couple of shipwrecks have been found. But they hint at a time of just unprecedented international cooperation. The Ulubarin shipwreck provides a clue that the Mycenaean Greeks were part of this diplomatic world. We can guess this because of the people on the boat and the gifts they appear to have been bringing. We don't yet have any letters from Mycenaean kings to the great kings of the other lands, but letters might well have existed and just not been found yet. The ship and its passengers were probably taking a circular route around the eastern Mediterranean. After unloading the goods and letting off the ambassadors in Greece, the vessel would have gone on to Crete, then across the Mediterranean to Egypt, and back along the coast eastwards to Canaan. Ships on this route probably also stopped at the city of Ugarit on the North Syrian coast. This was one of the great international ports of the Late Bronze Age. That's the period from around 1600 to 1200 BCE. Ugarit was in the orbit of Egyptian power, but it wasn't a vassal of Egypt. Its people didn't pay tribute. Documents found there Written in almost all the languages of the region, Akkadian, Egyptian, Hurrian, Hittite, Cyprominoan, and Ugaritic. So people who lived and worked there came from all over the place. Ugarit was rich from trade and from the manufacture and export of a vivid purple dye made from a shell called murex. The dye was so valuable that purple became the color of royalty for centuries afterward. Ugarit's royal family lived in a palace famous for being one of the most spectacular buildings in the region. The city prospered not only because of its strategic coastal location, but also because the era was peaceful and people could travel easily. So Ugarit had a diverse population and a thriving economy based on international trade and little interest in maintaining a military. This whole international system of trade and diplomacy between independent states worked smoothly for centuries. If you wanted glass, you got it from Canaan or Egypt. If you wanted silver, you got it from Anatolia. Copper came from Cyprus, which was ancient Alashia. Horses came from Mitanni in Syria. The best textiles came from Babylonia in what is now Iraq. Olive oil and perfume came from Greece. Ivory and ebony from Africa. Incense from Arabia, and gold from Egypt. Ships were probably built and manned in many different lands, and their cargoes and crews were international. Merchants, envoys, craftsmen, and guards traveled across the entire region regularly, both on the water and across land in caravans. Ideas and artistic styles spread as well, so that you can find a wall painting in Nuzi, way over in northeastern Mesopotamia, that was influenced by the artistic style that developed on the island of Crete, more than 1,500 miles to the west. Of course, the general economy was still based on agriculture. Each land seems to have produced enough food for its own people, supported by irrigation to water the fields and river valleys, or by rainfall. Even high officials typically owned farmland. They would hire laborers to work the land while also taking a personal interest in it. Now, one of the first things to go wrong with the international system didn't end up destroying it, but it was a shock. In Anatolia during the 14th century BCE, a Hittite prince named Supaliliuma swore allegiance to his brother the king, but then he had his brother killed so that he could take the throne. This was a heinous crime. Not just the murder, but also the fact that Supaliliuma had broken an oath to the gods. And this would come back to haunt him later. Supaliliuma was a contemporary of King Tushratta of Mitanni and of the pharaoh Akhenaten in Egypt, as well as of a king named Burnaboriash I in Babylonia. At first, Supaliliuma seemed to fit into the Brotherhood of Kings just fine. For instance, he had his ambassadors negotiate a marriage with Babylon, and he married King Burnaboriash's daughter. But soon, it was clear that he had no love for King Tushratta or for Mitanni. Supaliliuma launched a military campaign that devastated some of Mitanni's cities, though he was unable to capture the capital. The whole campaign upended a lot of the assumptions that populations in small cities and vassal kingdoms had about their safety. The leaders of the port city of Ugarit decided to side with him rather than to risk invasion. Tushratta of Mitanni died soon after this, killed by one of his sons. A relative then claimed the throne, while another of Tushratta's sons fled to Supaliliuma for help. The Hittite king agreed and gave him troops to help him seize the throne. But this Mitannian prince was no longer independent after his victory. His land was now subject to Hatti, the land of the Hittites. Cementing the new relationship between Hatti and Mitanni, the prince of Mitanni married Supaliliuma's daughter. But this wasn't a marriage between equals, like many of the other diplomatic marriages. Mitanni was no longer a major power. Instead, the western half of Mitanni now belonged to Hatti, and the eastern half declared its independence as the Kingdom of Assyria. Then, things began to settle down a little. The new king of Assyria made an alliance with the king of Babylon and, as usual, negotiated a diplomatic marriage. Assyria replaced Mitanni as a great power in the Brotherhood of Kings. As it happens, a really unusual diplomatic marriage almost happened at around this same time. A queen of Egypt wrote to Supililiuma, stating that her husband had died and she had no sons to succeed him. She'd heard that Supililiuma had many sons. Would he please send one of them to become her husband? We can't be sure of the Egyptian queen's name, but she was probably the widow of Tutankhamun or Akhenaten. And this request was totally unprecedented. She would have viewed anyone outside the royal family as a servant. And that was something of a problem, because, as she explained, she didn't want to marry a servant. Although there were probably plenty of high officials anxious to marry her and become pharaoh, she decided to take matters into her own hands and use the 1,000-year-old institution of diplomatic marriage to find herself a husband. This man was going to be someone who was her equal, a royal prince, not a commoner. The Hittites were allies, and she must have decided that a Hittite prince would do. Supililiuma was completely dumbfounded. He was so shocked that he sent an envoy to Egypt to check. Was this for real? Did the Egyptian queen really want to marry a Hittite prince? Would his son really become pharaoh? The Hittite envoy returned several months later with a curt reply from the queen. Of course she was telling the truth. Any Hittite prince that Supililiuma sent would become king of Egypt. Fair enough. Supililiuma chose his son Zenanza and presumably organized bridal gifts and the wedding party, and they sent them off to Egypt. On the way, though, the worst happened. Zenanza was murdered. Now relations between Egypt and Hatti collapsed. Supililiuma sent troops into a part of Canaan that Egypt controlled. Earlier in his reign, he'd sworn by the gods to abide by a peace treaty with Egypt. So here was Supililiuma breaking another oath. In taking prisoners of war and riches from Canaan, Supililiuma got something else as well, something no one wanted. The POWs he captured were infected with plague. The illness spread terribly through Hatti, eventually killing the king himself. To ancient eyes, the reason for this was obvious. Supililiuma had broken his oaths to the gods. Of course the gods would kill him. This is what Supililiuma's son wrote in a prayer to the gods in hopes of making the plague go away. He pleaded with them to spare the rest of the people. Too many had died. And eventually the plague did end. Through all of this, tensions stayed high between Egypt and Hatti until their armies met in battle in 1274 BCE. This was at Kadesh, located on the border between their empires in the western part of Syria. The Egyptian king was now Ramses II, who went on to rule for more than 60 years. In Ramses' account of the battle, he claimed that at one point he fought and was defeating the Hittite army single-handed. The Egyptians were completely victorious. But the Hittites also claimed to have won. Of course, it's impossible for both sides to have conquered one another. We do know that the Hittites kept control of the city of Kadesh. But mostly, it was a stalemate. Neither side was going to gain the upper hand. After a while, in 1258 BCE, the two sides agreed to an alliance, and they cemented it, as always, with a peace treaty and a diplomatic marriage. Ramses II married a Hittite princess. From that time on, Egypt and Hatti had a peaceful relationship, right up until both empires came to an end, about a century later. The reason the Late Bronze Age ended has been discussed a great deal, because it was so dramatic. Once things started going wrong, it was like a domino effect. The Late Bronze Age, from around 1600 to 1200 BCE, had been so stable and prosperous. The empires of Hatti and Egypt, the Kassite Kingdom of Babylonia, they'd lasted much longer than most previous kingdoms. But soon, it was all gone. The Hittite Empire completely collapsed by 1185 BCE, and the citadel of the capital city burned down. A few years later, in 1155 BCE, the Babylonian kingdom was invaded by the Elamites of modern-day Iran. The kingdom of Assyria, which had expanded when Mitanni was conquered, shrank back to an area around the capital city of Ashur. Egypt's long, stable New Kingdom period came to an end as well by 1070 BCE, after more than 400 years. Besides the big kingdoms, the smaller kingdoms of the Mediterranean also suffered. Actually, they seem to have suffered even more. Several Mycenaean cities of Greece were destroyed, and after the cities along the coast of Syria and Canaan gained independence from Hatti and Egypt, many of them were destroyed as well. What happened? There aren't many clues in the texts. In most places, it seems that documents just stopped being written around this time, with no indication as to why this was the case. But in the Syrian trade port of Ugarit, archaeologists found some letters that seem to have been written right before the city was destroyed by invaders. In one letter, the king of Ugarit, Amurapi, wrote urgently to the king of another city. He said that there were ships of the enemy visible at sea, and he needed help. It's not immediately clear who these enemies were, and his ally didn't send reinforcements. Instead, the neighboring king wrote back, telling him to surround your town with ramparts, have your troops and chariots enter there, and await the enemy with great determination. This was absolutely no help. Ugarit had never possessed much in the way of a military force, and the troops it did command were away, helping the king of Hatti. Now, those enemy ships arrived in the port and did enormous damage to the rich, unprotected Ugarit. Still, the embattled king, Amurapi, survived and was still in Ugarit when a letter arrived from the island of Cyprus, from the king of Alashia, who was asking him for help. Alashia was also being attacked. Amurapi wrote back that he couldn't be of any assistance at all. He explained that the enemy's ships came here, my cities were burned, thus the country is abandoned to itself. The seven ships of the enemy that came here inflicted great damage upon us. These unidentified enemies seem to have continued south along the coast, destroying and looting as they went. Their destination seems to have been Egypt, the richest of all Mediterranean lands. Unfortunately for us, the Egyptian king recorded the invaders' attack and his response. This was Ramses III, who later claimed to have achieved a glorious victory over the intruders. He covered the walls of his mortuary temple with relief sculptures and descriptions of the events. And here's how he tells the story. The foreign countries made a conspiracy in their islands. All at once, the lands were removed and scattered in the fray. No land could stand before their arms. From Hatti, Kode, Carchemish, Arzawa, and Alashia on, being cut off at one time. Their confederation was the Pelasset, Cheker, Shekelesh, Denyen, and Weshesh, lands united. So, the enemy invaders were from islands. They've come to be known as the Sea Peoples. Relief sculptures in Egypt show some of the invaders arriving in boats, and the scenes of battle have plenty of details. The defending Egyptian boats are all manned and orderly, whereas the foreign boats are distinctly non-Egyptian in shape and are all in disarray, with some of the enemy fighters falling into the sea. The enemies wear distinctive headdresses and kilts. They seem to have been observed and drawn from memory. It does seem as though people were on the move by boat, that Ramses III wasn't making this up. Some of the Sea Peoples are even shown arriving by land, in wagons, with women, children, and household possessions. They look as though they were coming to stay. It all looks pretty convincing. The Egyptian army and navy were able to repulse the foreigners, and some of them settled just to the north of Egypt on the coast of Canaan. The group known as the Pelasset show up in the Bible as the Philistines, and they gave their name to that area of the Levant, Palestine. Where did the Sea Peoples come from? Many archaeologists agree their origin was indeed across the sea. In fact, the architecture and pottery that began to be used at this time in Philistine sites are very much like Mycenaean architecture and pottery. Some of the sea peoples were probably Mycenaean Greeks. Others were probably from Cyprus and southern Anatolia. In fact, this might be the context of the Trojan War, which is believed to have happened right around this time in the 12th century BCE. According to Homer, this was a period when Greeks were fighting in northwestern Anatolia. The sea peoples would also have been on the move at this time, attacking coastal cities in the region. The memory of those campaigns might well have been the seed behind the whole epic tale of the Greeks fighting the Trojans. So why were the sea peoples on the move? There are a lot of possibilities. Perhaps there was a drought in their homelands, and they were refugees fleeing starvation. There is some evidence for a drought, not just in Greece, but across the northern Mediterranean. Hatti seems to have imported grain from Ugarit and from Egypt around 1200. And the king wrote about a famine when he requested the grain. Previously, they had been able to grow enough food in an area that depended on rainfall to water crops. A few years of drought, therefore, could be devastating. People from the whole region would have suffered, and many could have fled, looking for somewhere to live where food was more plentiful. Another possibility is that a series of earthquakes caused huge fires. There's evidence for earthquake damage and burned buildings at several sites in the region. Again, this would have been devastating to local inhabitants. People might have had to move in order to survive, becoming refugees. Still, scholars think that neither drought nor earthquakes were sufficient to be responsible for the amount of upheaval that marked the end of the great Bronze Age civilizations. Another possible explanation is that the extreme gap between the rich and poor of the time might have resulted in the poor rising up. It's certainly true that the elites in the late Bronze Age lived in great luxury and depended on the poor to provide much of their wealth. The palaces, for example, had something of a monopoly on bronze. Weavers worked for the palaces to make beautiful textiles and were paid in food rations, while the textiles were used as luxury gifts for which the king might receive gold or silver in return. Some people do seem to have resisted the amount of work they were called upon to perform for the palaces and temples. In Canaan, there was a group of outlaws known as the Habiru, who seem to have abandoned urban life. And in peace treaties of the time, one of the main concerns was always with the extradition of fugitives who left one land and tried to live in another. This wouldn't have been a major negotiating point if it hadn't been an ongoing problem. A significant number of people must have fled their cities and their debts and the demands the state put on them to try to live somewhere else. The destruction of palaces and citadels at some sites might have been the work of unhappy local subjects rather than invaders. There's no confirmation of this, but it would help explain why some cities were destroyed while others had no destruction at all, and why in some cities only the citadel was destroyed while private houses were untouched. Once the seeds of rebellion were sown, or an armed migration of refugees was unleashed, it seems that other things began to break down. It's not that the sea peoples showed up everywhere, but instead that similar types of destruction spread across the region. For example, there's no sign that the sea peoples made it to Hatti, even though the palaces of the Hittite capital were destroyed. The capital city was far inland, hundreds of miles from the route of the sea peoples. So the attackers on the Hittite capital might have come from closer to home, the neighboring Gazga people, perhaps. Or this destruction might also have been a result of social unrest among the Hittite population. The sea peoples didn't directly cause the reversals in Assyria and Babylonia either. What seems likely is that a whole lot of things got out of balance. Whatever the first trigger was, whether drought, rebellion, earthquakes, or all three, the system began to disintegrate. Things became quite dangerous in some regions. Some people took to the roads in wagons or to the sea in boats to pursue life elsewhere. Raiders looted and burned buildings. People couldn't travel safely to trade or deliver messages or luxury gifts anymore. Great kings lost contact with one another and had no source for the expensive foreign goods they wanted. Ships like the one found at Uluburun no longer could peacefully tie up at ports around the Mediterranean and expect a civil welcome. All around the Mediterranean coast, small states now replaced the big empires. In Greece, for example, people were much poorer than before, with simple grave goods replacing elaborate ones. Overseas trade seems to have stopped. The Mycenaeans had used a writing system that modern scholars call Linear B, but that too was forgotten. All over the place, there were fewer big cities and many more people living in the countryside. And it wasn't a peaceful time. Battles took place regularly between the various small kingdoms. This period, from about 1155 to 972 BCE, is often referred to as a Dark Age, because not much documentation survives to help us understand what was going on. Tablets inscribed with cuneiform texts are rarely found at the archaeological sites from this era. This might be because people were writing on papyrus, which typically doesn't survive for hundreds or thousands of years. But you do get the sense of a very different era from the one that came before. In spite of all the gaps in our knowledge about this era, there is one giant source of information for history in the Levant during this time, and that's the Hebrew Bible. This era was when the Kingdom of Israel formed. It was the time of Israel's battles against the Philistines and the Canaanites, and of its first kings. The Bible describes Solomon's relationships with the neighboring land of Tyre and with other kingdoms, like distant Sheba. The leaders exchanged luxury goods, and Solomon married the daughters of neighboring kings. It does look from the Bible as though some aspects of the old diplomatic system were still working. But the long era of peace and international cooperation between major kingdoms, that had come to an end. Once the system started to break down, it was impossible to save it. The old empires were divided up into smaller, squabbling kingdoms. If these kingdoms kept many records, they don't seem to have survived.
Lecture 20, Assyria Ascending.
As a child growing up in England, one of the most exciting things I can remember was going to London for the day. I was terrified of riding the underground trains, but everything else seemed magical. One of my most vivid memories is of visiting the British Museum, and especially the giant winged lion statues at the entrance to the Assyrian galleries. This was long before I decided to spend my career studying ancient Mesopotamia. I was just a schoolgirl. But the majesty of those sculpted lions was almost overwhelming. They were immense, up to 14 feet tall. From the front, each one looked like a bearded man. But his head was set on the body and legs of a giant cat, and he wore a horned crown. From the side, each stone figure appeared to be striding forwards, with wings that spread right across the top of his back, as though he were about to take off in flight. I'd never seen anything so impressive or otherworldly. Later, during graduate school, I went back to visit these giant lion men, and they still took my breath away. The Assyrian kings who created them might never have guessed that they would still stand guard over a doorway thousands of years later. But now they were in a London museum rather than in the Assyrian capital. The Assyrian kings might have been pleased, though, to know that these sculptures still have the power to make us gasp. The empire of the Assyrians was centered on the Tigris River in northern Mesopotamia. And through all the thousands of years of history that separate us from them, their legend lived on. The Sumerians and Akkadians of southern Mesopotamia would be forgotten for thousands of years. They had to be rediscovered in the 19th century. But the Assyrians were immortalized by the Bible and by Greek and Roman authors. They were never forgotten. And so, when archaeologists first started digging in Iraq during the mid-19th century, it was evidence of the Assyrian Empire that they were looking for. They found it. and it was just as impressive as they had imagined. It turns out that Assyria existed long before the time of the Bible. Until the 14th century BCE, it was just one state among many in Mesopotamia. In fact, through much of the 15th and 14th centuries BCE, Assyria was subject to the kingdom of Mitanni, the great power that dominated northern Mesopotamia. But western Mitanni was subsumed into the Hittite Empire around the 1330s BCE, and Assyria regained its independence. For the next 700 years, until the end of the 7th century BCE, Assyria played a huge role in Mesopotamian history. It was led by one of the most stable dynasties anywhere in all of history, with the throne passing from father to son over and over again. Eventually, the Assyrians created an empire on a huge scale, much bigger than anything that had come before. And it set the basic model for how an empire should be run. All later empires in the Near East and the Mediterranean regions, the empires of the Babylonians, the Persians, the Greeks, and the Romans, they all learned from the Assyrians. Before I start discussing the details of the Assyrian phenomenon, I should be clear about some terms. First is the term Assyria. That's not what the Assyrians called their country. They called it Ashur. Their capital city was also known as Ashur. And the god of the city and the land of Ashur was also named Ashur. The god Ashur wasn't a cosmic god. He wasn't a planet or a star or a force of nature. He was physically present in the city of Ashur as the rock formation on top of which his temple was built, towering above the river. So they had a god, a city, and a country, all with the same name. Imagine today if we had a country called God with a capital city, also called God. You might assume that the people there would be pretty religious, pretty devoted to God, and that does seem to have been true in Ashur. They absolutely believed in the power and the supremacy of their god. It's not that they didn't believe in other gods as well, or that they were monotheists. They still worshipped the whole pantheon of Mesopotamian gods. But in their minds, it was Ashur, not Enlil, who was the most powerful, the king of the gods. In any event, to make things a little less confusing, we now refer to their country as Assyria rather than Ashur. The heartland of Assyria, that is the area that always remains subject to this long dynasty of kings, was mostly located along the Tigris River. Its southern edge lies in the area around the city of Ashur, which remained the religious capital of Assyria even after the political capital was moved further north up the Tigris River, first to the city of Kalhu and ultimately to Nineveh. Nineveh was next to present-day Mosul and north of Ashur by about 60 miles. It marked the northern edge of the heartland. And in the east, closer to the Zagros Mountains, was the city of Arbela, about 60 miles northeast from Ashur and about 50 miles east of Nineveh. If you lived anywhere in this triangle, at any time through the 7th century BCE, you lived in the land of Assyria. The lands beyond the triangle were sometimes under the control of other kingdoms, but there was no obvious boundary to Assyria. It didn't have a coastline, and it wasn't right next to a mountain range. So the Assyrian kings always felt vulnerable to attack. From the 14th century onward, these kings wanted to expand their boundaries, and not only for defensive purposes. Conquering neighboring lands for the god Ashur was seen as a religious thing to do, an act of piety. In spite of Assyria's lack of obvious borders, it had some advantages for the people who lived there. There was enough rainfall for farming, so farms were scattered all across the landscape. Unlike in the south, farms weren't located only by the rivers. And Assyria was at the crossroads of several major roads and trading routes. In fact, the cities of Ashur and Nineveh were both located where it was possible to ford the Tigris. So lots of commerce came through. The era of the Assyrian kingdom that thrived during the late 2nd millennium BCE is known as the Middle Assyrian period. It was at its height from around 1365 to 1076 BCE. This was around 500 years after the end of the Old Assyrian period, when Assyrian merchants traded and set up colonies in what is now Turkey. That period had lasted from around 1974 to 1807 BCE. The Middle Assyrian period is also distinct